Chapter 4. Understanding Globalization. Engines, Microchips, and Beyond. Globalization manifests itself in countless quotidian ways. Ships, loaded with many thousands of interlocking steel containers, are bringing electronic and kitchen gadgets, socks and pants, garden tools and sports equipment from Asia to the shopping centers of Europe and North America, as well as to hawkers of cheap clothes and kitchenware in Africa and Latin America. Giant tankers move crude oil from Saudi Arabia to refineries in India and Japan, and liquefied natural gas from Texas to storage tanks in France and South Korea. Large bulk carriers full of iron ore leave Brazil for China and return empty, as do the oil tankers, to their home ports. Apple's American-designed iPhones are assembled in a Taiwanese-owned factory. Honhai Precision trading as Foxconn in Shenzhen in China's Guangdong province, from parts coming from more than a dozen countries. The phones are then distributed globally in a highly choreographed feat of integrated engineering and marketing. International migrations include families from Punjab or Lebanon arriving in Toronto and Sydney on scheduled jet flights. Migrants risking their lives in rubber dinghies as they try to reach Lampedusa or Malta. And young adults seeking higher education abroad in London, Paris, or in small colleges in Iowa and Kansas. Travel for leisure has reached such levels that in many cases the pre-pandemic label of over-tourism was but a mild description of what was taking place in Rome's San Pietro, where the Basilica was jammed with selfie-stick-wielding tourists on quick-package European tours, or on Asian beaches that became so degraded they had to be closed to visitors. The COVID-19 pandemic's onset led to new acute over-tourism crises, as hundreds of elderly people were shut in on cruise ships off the shores of Japan or Madagascar in the early spring of 2020. And yet before the end of the year, even as new waves of infection were rising fast around the world, major companies advertised new megaship cruises for 2021. Such is modern restlessness. Statistics concerning money movements greatly underestimate the real, including massive illegal, flows. The global merchandise trade is now close to $20 trillion a year, and the annual value of world trade in commercial services is close to $6 trillion. Global foreign direct investment doubled between 2000 and 2019 and now approaches $1.5 trillion a year, while by 2020 global currency trading totaled nearly $7 trillion per day. And numbers describing global information flows are many orders of magnitude higher than these money transfers, not just in terabytes or petabytes, but in exa, 10 to the power of 18, and yotta, 10 to the power of 24 bytes of data. Obviously, understanding how the modern world really works cannot be done without appreciating the evolution, the extent, and the consequences of this multifaceted process, which entails, according to what I think is perhaps the best concise definition, the growing interdependence of the world's economies, cultures, and populations brought about by cross-border trade in goods and services, technology, and flows of investment, people, and information. Contrary to widely held beliefs, the process is not new. Moving jobs to countries with low labour costs, labour arbitrage, is just one of its several requisite drivers, and there is nothing inevitable about its future expansion and intensification. Perhaps the greatest misconception about globalization is that it is a historical inevitability preordained by economic and social evolution. Not so. Globalization is not, as a former US president claimed, the economic equivalent of a force of nature like wind or water. It is just another human construct. And there is now a growing consensus that, in some ways, it has already gone too far and needs to be readjusted. In this chapter, I will show that globalization is a process with considerable history. Although in the past the rising flows of goods, investment, and people were not subsumed under the label, and the recent attention to the phenomenon escalated due to its extent, not because of its novelty. Google's Engram viewer charts provide excellent illustrations of long-term trends of attention paid to any notable developments. The chart for globalization consists of a near-zero flatline until the mid-1980s, then a steep rise of interest during the next two decades, a 40-fold rise of frequency between 1987 and 2006 when interest peaked, followed by a 33% decline by 2018. If low labor costs were the sole reason for locating new factories abroad, as many people seem to erroneously believe, then sub-Saharan Africa would be the most obvious choice, and India would almost always be preferable to China. But during the second decade of the 21st century, China averaged about $230 billion of foreign direct investment a year, compared to less than $50 billion for India and just around $40 billion for all of sub-Saharan Africa, excluding South Africa. China provided a combination of other attractors, above all, centralized one-party government that could guarantee political stability and acceptable investment conditions, a large, highly homogeneous and literate population, and an enormous domestic market that made it the preferred choice over Nigeria, Bangladesh and even India, resulting in a remarkable collusion between the world's largest communist state and a nearly complete lineup of the world's leading capitalist enterprises. Globalization has been linked approvingly with the advantages, benefits, creative destruction, modernity, and progress it has brought to entire nations. China has been by far its greatest beneficiary, as the country's reintegration into the global economy helped to reduce the number of people living in extreme poverty by 94% between 1980 and 2015. But these gains and praises coexist with various degrees of disapproval or even outright rejection of the process, with the discontent and anger that have resulted from the loss of well-paying jobs to offshoring, with post-2000 losses especially prominent in several sectors of the US economy, from the race to the bottom as labor arbitrage drives remunerations ever lower, and from growing inequality and new kinds of immiseration. While there is much with which to agree and disagree in these reactions and analyses, this chapter will be neither a reiteration of often told narratives that have crowded economic publications of the past two generations, nor a polemic about the desirability of the phenomenon. My goal is to explain how technical factors, above all new prime movers, engines, turbines, motors, and new means of communication and information, storage, transmission, and retrieval, made successive waves of globalization possible, and then to point out how these technical advances have been contingent on the prevailing political and social conditions. As a result, there is nothing inevitable about the continuation and further intensification of the process and the significant decades-long post-1913 retreat from globalization, as well as recent reversals and concerns about the security of existing supply chains, serve as obvious reminders of this reality. Globalization's distant origins. In its most fundamental physical way, globalization is, and will remain, simply the movement of mass, raw materials, foodstuffs, finished products, and people, and the transmission of information, warnings, guidance, news, data, ideas, and investment within and among the continents, enabled by techniques that make such transfers possible on large scales and in affordable and reliable ways. Inevitably, these transfers entail energy conversions, and while moving mass and transmitting information can be done by deploying human and animal muscles, carrying loads, sending messengers on horseback, these animate prime movers have very limited power, endurance, and range. And, of course, they are incapable of bridging the oceans. Sails, going back to the Egypt of more than 5,000 years ago, were the first inanimate energy converters to make such links possible. But only steam engines, aided by better means of navigation, brought the large-scale, low-cost and reliable interchange, and only with the post-1900 diffusion of internal combustion engines, on land, on the ocean and in the air, and the post-1955 adoption of solid-state or semiconductor electronics has this process increased to unprecedented levels. But these innovations intensified globalization. They didn't launch it. The process, unlike its post-1985 prominence, is not a new phenomenon. And in this chapter, I will trace both the timing and the extent of its past waves, and the limits of their eventual reach and intensity. The process began a long time ago, but its first rounds were inherently limited. Trading obsidian along prehistoric routes in parts of the Old World more than 6,000 years ago is not, as has recently been claimed, an example of globalization. But many ties before the European discovery of America were relatively intensive and truly intercontinental. Ships sailed regularly from Berenica, the Red Sea port in Roman Egypt, to India, as they did from Basra. Cassius Dio wrote in 116 CE how the Emperor Trajan, during his temporary occupation of Mesopotamia, stood at the Persian Gulf's shore, watching a ship leaving for India and wishing that he were as young as Alexander, who had led his armies to that faraway country. Chinese silk made it, via the Parthian Empire, all the way to Rome, as did regular shipments of grain and extraordinarily heavy loads of ancient obelisks from Egypt and wild animals from Mauritania Tingitana, northern Morocco. But the scattered linking of parts of Europe, Asia and Africa is a far cry from a truly global reach. Only the inclusion of the New World, starting in 1492, and the first circumnavigation of the Earth in 1519, began to satisfy this definition. And a mere century later, commercial exchanges tied European states with the interior of Asia, India, and the Far East, as well as with coastal regions of Africa and with both Americas, and only Australia was still left aside. Some of these early links were as enduring as they were transformative. East India Company, headquartered in London and operating between 1600 and 1874, traded a wide range of items, largely to and from the Indian subcontinent, ranging from textiles and metals to spices and opium. The Dutch East India Company imported spices, textiles, gems and coffee, mostly from Southeast Asia. It kept its uninterrupted monopoly on trade with Japan for two centuries, between 1641 and 1858, and the Dutch domination of the East Indies ended only in 1945. At the same time, technical capabilities put clear limits on the frequency and intensity of these early exchanges, and here I will use their key markers: the maximum power and speed of individual modes of transport and the ability to communicate over long distances ever more quickly and reliably, to trace the four distinct eras of globalization. Incipient globalization eventually connected the world with far-flung but not very intensive exchanges enabled by sail ships. Steam engines made these linkages more common, more intensive, and much more predictable, while telegraph provided the first truly global means of near-instant communication. The combination of the first diesel engines, flight, and radio elevated and accelerated these enablers of globalization. And large diesels in shipping, turbines in flight, containers enabling intermodal transport, and microchips allowing unprecedented controls thanks to the volume and speed of information handling brought globalization to its highest stage. Wind-driven globalization. Starting at the beginning, the limits of globalization dependent solely on animate power are easily stated. Human and animal muscles were the only prime movers on land, restricting the weight of goods that could be carried by porters, maxima of 40 to 50 kilograms, or by animal caravans, horses or camels, loads of 100 to 150 kilograms per animal, and limiting their daily progress. Caravans on the Silk Road from Tanis on the Black Sea via Sarai to Beijing took a year, implying an average speed of about 25 kilometers per day. Wooden sail ships undertaking long-distance voyages were far from numerous, and they had small capacities, travelled slowly, lacked accurate means of navigation, and frequently failed to complete their journeys. Detailed records of Dutch shipping to Asia document these limits. They show that the average duration of a voyage to Batavia, present-day Jakarta, was 238 days, or 8 months, during the 17th century, and another month from Batavia to Dejima, the small Dutch outpost in the Nagasaki harbour. And average speeds during the 18th century were slightly slower, with journeys taking 245 days. Given the distance of 15,000 nautical miles, 27,780 kilometres, between Amsterdam and Batavia, this implies an average speed of 4.7 kilometres per hour, the equivalent of rather slow walking. That poor average is a result of some half-decent speeds when running before the wind coming from directly behind the vessel, and other days when ships were becalmed by the equatorial doldrums, or when long spells of strong prevailing winds required laborious tacking, or giving up and waiting for the wind to shift. During the 17th and 18th centuries, the Dutch built only 1,450 new ships for Asian trade, averaging 7 a year, with capacities of just 700 to 1,000 tons. That was good enough to make a profit, carrying such high-value cargoes as spices, tea, and china, but completely uneconomical for any trade in bulk commodities. Valuable Japanese copper was the major exception. And while the sailings to Batavia were limited by the availability of ships and the risks of travel, sailings to Japan were restricted by the Tokugawa shoguns to no more than 2 to 7 ships a year and to just one arrival a year during the 1790s. And because the Dutch East India Company kept detailed records, we also know the number of people who boarded the more than 4,700 ships bound from the Netherlands to the East Indies. Nearly 1 million people made this journey between 1595 and 1795, but that is just 5,000 a year, and about 15% of them died before reaching Ceylon or Batavia. Even so, during the second century of the early modern era, 1500 to 1800, the societies at the forefront of this still modest but rising wave of globalisation were influenced by these long-range interchanges. Not surprisingly, given their newly acquired riches and contact with other continents, the lives of urban elites during the Dutch Republic's Golden Age, 1608 to 1672, offer perhaps the best examples of these new benefits. Their growing range of possessions and experiences were the obvious markers of the gains derived from trade and from material and cultural exchanges, and many famous painters provide a fascinating record of this incipient affluence. Works by Dirk Hals, Gerard de Borg, Frans van Mieris, Jan Vermeer van Delft, and many lesser masters show these new profits turned into tiled floors, glass windows, well-made furniture, thick tablecloths, and musical instruments. Some have argued that this can all be dismissed because this genre of painting depicted a fantasy world that never existed in reality. Exaggeration and stylization were certainly present, but as historian Jan de Vries makes clear, what he calls the new luxury, generated by urban society, was real, not striving for grandeur and excess, but evinced in products of good craftsmanship, from furniture to tapestries, from Delft tiles to silver utensils, including about 3 million paintings owned by families in Holland in the 1660s. And there were other, more direct proofs of reaching out and bringing in. The presence of Africans in Amsterdam, the popularity of maps, the profitable business of compiling and publishing atlases, the consumption of sugar and exotic fruits, the import of spices. The Dutch colonisation of the East Indies began in 1607 by taking over Ternate, the largest producer of cloves, followed shortly afterwards by occupying the nutmeg-growing Banda Islands, and the drinking of tea and coffee. But these early exchanges had limited economic impact, as they never reached beyond the small segments of people who benefited from the new ventures. The countryside was left with its traditional ways. This was just an incipient, selective, and limited globalisation without any substantial nationwide impacts, to say nothing about truly global consequences. For example, economist Angus Maddison estimated that in 1698 to 1700, commodity exports from the East Indies accounted for just 1.8% of the Dutch net domestic product, and that the Indonesian export surplus was a mere 1.1% of the Dutch GDP. And nearly a century later, 1778 to 1780, both of these shares were still only 1.7%. Steam engines and telegraph. The first quantitative leap in the process of globalization came only with the combination of more reliable navigation, steam power, resulting in larger ship capacities and faster speeds, and the telegraph, the first means of nearly instant long-distance communication. Navigation came first in 1765 with John Harrison's fourth highly accurate sea clock, a chronometer which made it possible to determine exact longitude. But the leap in speeds and capacities had to wait until steam engines displaced sails in intercontinental shipping, when screws made paddle wheels obsolete, and when steel-hulled ships became dominant. The first steam-powered westward transatlantic crossings took place in 1838, but sailing ships remained competitive for another four decades. With wind as the prime mover, the cost of carrying a unit of cargo per unit of distance by a sailing ship was largely independent of the length of the voyage. The more of the vessel's deadweight capacity had to be loaded with coal to fuel relatively inefficient engines, leaving less room for cargo. Refueling stations reduced but did not eliminate this disadvantage. This long coexistence of sail and steam is well documented by the German transition. By 1873, sailing ships had lost the competition on the intra-European routes, while on the intercontinental routes, sails had the advantage until 1880, but lost it rapidly afterwards with the adoption of more efficient engines. All pioneering steamships crossing the Atlantic were propelled by paddle wheels, but screw propulsion was commercially introduced during the 1840s, and in 1877, Lloyd's Register of Shipping approved steel as an insurable construction material, just as new production methods made the metal abundant and affordable, as mentioned in Chapter 3. Steel hulls and screws and large steam engines made it possible to cover reliably 30 and then 40 kilometres per hour, compared to the average of 20 kilometres per hour for the fastest clippers of the 1850s, and long-distance shipping also gained new markets with the exports of live cattle, and starting in the 1870s, chilled meat, carried almost exclusively by passenger liners, and butter from the US, Australia and New Zealand. Practical telegraph was developed during the late 1830s and the early 1840s. The first short-lived transatlantic link cable was laid in 1858, and by the century's end, undersea cables had connected all continents. For the first time in history, trading could take into consideration the knowledge of demand and prices in different parts of the world, and the availability of a new, powerful prime mover could translate this information into profitable international exchanges. When the price of Iowa beef was cheaper than British beef of inferior quality, and new refrigerating techniques became available, for example, the exports of frozen American meat rose rapidly, more than quadrupling between the late 1870s and the late 1900s. During this wave of steam-driven globalization, the role of the telephone, a device far superior to telegraph for direct personal communication, remained limited. Its patenting and the first public demonstration in 1876 were followed by a slow diffusion of service, mediated by manual exchanges. US telephone ownership rose from less than 50,000 in 1880 to 1.35 million by 1900. One phone for every 56 Americans. Calling distances expanded gradually. A call from New York to Chicago could be made only in 1892. The first transcontinental calls to San Francisco, via multiple exchanges, came in 1915, and a three-minute conversation cost about $20, or more than $500 in 2020 monies. The first intercontinental call from the US to the UK came only in 1927, and even the monopolised domestic service remained relatively expensive for the next two generations. But the advances in intercontinental shipping, combined with rapid post-1840 construction of railroads across Europe and North America, as well as in India, other regions of Asia and Latin America, created the first wave of a truly large-scale globalization. The total volume of global trade quadrupled between 1870 and 1913. The share of trade, exports and imports, in the worldwide economic product rose from about 5% in 1850 to 9% by 1870 and to 14% in 1913. And the best estimates for 13 countries, including Australia, Canada, France, Japan, Mexico and the UK, show their combined share rising from 30% in 1870 to 50% just before the First World War. Large steamliners were also able to move passengers on an unprecedented scale. During the sailing era, packet ships carried 250 to 700 steerage passengers. By the first decade of the 20th century, a steamliner might carry more than 2,000 passengers. Leisure travel, a form of temporary migration formerly reserved for the privileged classes, took off in its many manifestations with steam-powered trains and ships. With Thomas Cook leading the way in 1841, travel agencies offered package tours, and spa and seaside vacations became fashionable as people visited Baden-Baden, Carlsbad, and Vichy, and travelled to Trouville on the French Atlantic coast or to Capri. Some of these trips were transcontinental. Affluent Russian families took trains all the way from Moscow and St. Petersburg to the French Riviera. Some travellers sought physical challenges, newly fashionable alpine mountaineering, while others went on more affordable religious pilgrimages. And this new mobility also had a distinctly political dimension, with exiles travelling by trains and ships seeking refuge in foreign countries. Most famously, nearly all future prominent Bolshevik leaders, Lenin, Leon Trotsky, Nikolai Bukharin, Grigory Zinoviev, spent many years abroad in Europe and the US. And I think it is quite reasonable to argue that steam globalization also helped to create a new kind of literary sensibility, with Joseph Conrad, or Yusef Korzenovsky, as its master. The protagonists of his three greatest novels find themselves far from their homes thanks to the era's mass trade and travel. Nostromo in South America, Jim in Asia, Marlowe in Africa. And their lives and misfortunes were linked to steamships. Nostromo, in the eponymous novella, is known as Capataz de Cargadores, head longshoreman. Jim's life takes a tragic turn while he is helping transport Muslim pilgrims from Asia to Mecca in Lord Jim, and Marlowe's transformation could not have taken place without Western goods being brought deep into the Congo Basin in Heart of Darkness. The first diesel engines, flight and radio. The next fundamental advance in prime movers that raised the capability of long-distance shipping was the replacement of steam engines with diesel engines, machines of superior efficiency and reliable performance. Two concurrent processes that promoted further globalization were the invention of airplanes powered by reciprocating gasoline engines and radio communication. The first brief flights by the Wright brothers took place in late 1903. Hundreds of planes flew in combat during the First World War, and the first airline company, the Dutch KLM, was set up in 1921. The first transatlantic radio signal arrived in December 1901. The French Army deployed the first portable transmitters for air-to-ground communication in 1916, and the first commercial radio stations began to broadcast in the early 1920s. Rudolf Diesel deliberately set out to design a new, more efficient prime mover, and by 1897, his first heavy and stationary engine had reached an efficiency of 30%, double the performance of the best steam engines. But the first marine engine was installed only in 1912 on Christian X, a Danish freighter. Diesel-powered ships carried much less fuel than coal-fired steamers, but could travel further without refueling because the new engines were nearly twice as efficient. And because, per unit of mass, diesel oil contains nearly twice as much energy. An American engineer, who saw the first diesel-powered vessel after her maiden voyage to New York in 1912, concluded that marine history is being written by the advent of the diesel engine. By the 1930s, when diesel engines conquered the shipping market, the rapidly maturing aviation industry began to deliver the first airplanes capable of flying profitably over long distances. In 1936 came the first deliveries of the Douglas DC-3, a twin-engine aircraft capable of carrying up to 32 passengers, just a bit faster than the landing speed of modern jetliners. 3 years later came the Boeing 314 Clipper, a long-range flying boat with an impressive range of 5,633 kilometres. Still not enough to cross the Pacific, but more than enough to reach Honolulu from San Francisco before continuing to Midway, Wake, Guam and Manila to reach Asia. The Clipper had no shortage of physical comforts for its 74 passengers, including a stateroom and a dining room, dressing rooms and seats that converted into bunks. But there was no way to eliminate the noise and vibration of reciprocating engines, and the highest cruising altitude, 5.9 kilometres, was still too low to put it above the most turbulent atmospheric layers. With three stops, it took 15 and a half hours from New York to Los Angeles, and the first London to Singapore link in 1934 took 8 days with 22 layovers, including Athens, Cairo, Baghdad, Basra, Sharjah, Jodhpur, Calcutta and Rangoon. But long as it was a considerable improvement on the approximately 30 days needed to travel by ship from Southampton via the Suez Canal. Radio was of critical importance for better sea and air navigation, and compared to the telegraph, it was also a superior tool for mass-scale dissemination of instant information. Radio communication was deployed first on transatlantic ocean liners, thanks to Titanic's distress message, CQD Titanic 41.44 North 50.24 West, sent at 12:15 a.m. on April 15, 1912, 700 people in lifeboats were saved by Carpathia. Radio navigation made great advances during the 1930s with the introduction of range stations. Planes on course to an airport heard a continuous audio tone. Those drifting off course heard N Morse code. Dash dot when to the left of the path. A dot dash when right of it. Wireless broadcasts required no expensive undersea cables, and they could achieve wide area coverage and universal access. Anybody with a simple receiver could listen. Not surprisingly, the adoption of radio receivers was rapid. Within a decade after their introduction, 60% of American families had them, nearly as fast a rate of acquisition as that of black and white TVs, which also originated in the 1920s after the Second World War, and a faster rate than the subsequent diffusion of colour TV, which in the US took off rapidly during the early 1960s. Marine diesels and reciprocating aircraft engines remained the technical enablers of globalization during the two interwar decades, and their mass-scale deployment made the decisive contribution to the outcome of the Second World War. By the conflict's end, the US had built nearly 296,000 airplanes, compared to about 112,000 in Germany and 68,000 in Japan. In 1945, the United States emerged as the world's dominant power, and the economic recovery of Western Europe was fast. Aided by the US investment, 1948's Marshall Plan, all of the region's countries surpassed their pre-war, 1934 to 1938, level of industrial production by 1949, while Japan's recovery was accelerated by the contribution of that country's industries to the Korean War. The stage was thus set for a period of unprecedented growth and integration, as well as for extensive social and cultural interactions. Communist economies, led by the USSR and China, were the notable exceptions. Although they reported impressive economic growth rates, they were highly autarkic and operated with very little foreign trade beyond their bloc, and kept their citizens from travelling abroad. Large diesels, turbines, containers, and microchips. This distinct and intensive, but still far from universal, spell of post-1950 globalization, which ended in 1973 to 1974 with OPEC's two rounds of oil price increases and which was followed by 15 years of relative stagnation, was enabled by a combination of four fundamental technical advances. These were the rapid adoption of much more powerful and efficient designs of diesel engines, the introduction and even faster diffusion of a new prime mover, the gas turbine used for the propulsion of jetliners, superior designs for intercontinental shipping, massive bulk carriers for liquids and solids, and the containerization of other cargoes, and quantum leaps in computing and information processing. These advances took off with the first electronic computers, which used unreliable and bulky vacuum tubes and were built during and right after the Second World War. And their progress was revolutionized by the patenting, 1947 to 1949, and commercialization, starting in 1954, of the first transistors, devices that remain the foundation of modern solid-state electronics. The next step, late 1950s to early 1960s, was placing increasing numbers of transistors on a microchip to create integrated circuits. And in 1971, Intel released its 4004, the world's first microprocessor. It contained 2,300 transistors, forming a complete general-purpose central processing unit suitable for many programmable applications. And despite the recent perceptions of the transformative nature of technical capabilities deployed since the beginning of the 21st century, above all advances in artificial intelligence and synthetic biology, our world is still beholden to these critical pre-1973 achievements. Moreover, as there are no immediate available alternatives that could be deployed for the same tasks on similarly massive scales, we will depend on these techniques, be they giant marine diesel engines, container ships and wide-body jetliners, or microprocessors, for decades to come. And that is also why these techniques deserve a closer look. The scale of global economic expansion between 1950 and 1973 is best illustrated by the growing output of the four material pillars of modern civilization. For their assessment, refer to Chapter 3. And by the world's rising energy demand, Chapter 1. Steel production nearly quadrupled from about 190 to 698 megatons per year. Cement production increased almost sixfold, from 133 to 770 megatons. Ammonia synthesis almost eightfold, from less than 5 to 37 megatons of nitrogen, and plastic output was more than 26 times higher, from less than 2 to 45 megatons. Primary energy output nearly tripled, and crude oil consumption rose almost sixfold as the world became increasingly dependent on Middle Eastern oil. As a result, there is no contest as to which technique has made the greatest difference in enabling mass-scale transport in the global economy. Without diesel engines, intercontinental trade in bulk cargoes, from grain to crude oil, would have been just a small fraction of recent shipments. After the Second World War, crude oil tankers were the first vessels to grow in capacity, as the rapid economic growth of Western Europe and Japan coincided with the availability of newly discovered Middle Eastern giant oil fields. Saudi Arabia's Gawa, the world's largest, was found in 1948 and began flowing in 1951. And exports of this inexpensive fuel, until 1971 it sold for less than $2 per barrel, required vessels of increasing capacities. Typical pre-1950 oil tankers had capacity of only 16,000 deadweight tons, mostly the ship's cargo, but also its fuel, ballast, provision and crew. The first tanker of more than 50,000 deadweight tons was launched in 1956. By the mid-1960s, Japanese shipyards began launching very large crude carriers, VLCC, with capacities of between 180,000 and 320,000 deadweight tons. Beyond that came ultra-large crude carriers, or ULCC, and seven ships larger than 500,000 deadweight tons were launched during the 1970s. Too large to allow for flexible routing, as they can be accommodated only at the deepest ports. This growing fleet made it possible to increase the shipments of Middle Eastern oil from less than 50 megatons in 1950 to about 850 megatons by 1972. Even as crude oil exports were soaring during the late 1950s and early 1960s, there was no way to ship natural gas, a cleaner fuel than coal or refined oil fuels, and also well suited both to industrial and household uses and to the highly efficient generation of electricity. Intercontinental natural gas shipments became possible with the introduction of the first liquefied natural gas, or LNG tankers, carrying the fuel at minus 162 degrees Celsius in insulated containers, which brought exports from Algeria to the UK starting in 1964 and from Alaska to Japan in 1969. But for decades, the ships were of low capacity and the market was limited to long-term contracts with a small number of buyers. Growing intercontinental trade required new modes of specialised shipping. Bulk carriers with large compartments and massive watertight hatches were designed to transport coal, grain, ores, cement and fertiliser, and they could be rapidly loaded and unloaded. But the greatest shipping innovation came in 1957, when a North Carolina trucker, Malcolm McLean, finally transformed his pre-Second World War idea, carrying cargo in uniformly sized steel boxes, which are easy to load by large port cranes and can be offloaded directly onto waiting trucks or trains or stacked temporarily for later distribution, into a commercial reality. In October 1957, Gateway City, a freighter whose hold was fitted with cellular compartments to accommodate 226 stacked containers, became the world's first true container ship, and McLean's Sea Land Company began a regular container service to Europe, Newark to Rotterdam in April 1966 and to Japan in 1968. New ships were also needed for expanding intercontinental car exports. The American market opened up first to Volkswagen's Beetle, the first car imported already in 1949, and then to small Japanese designs, the Toyopet since 1958, Honda N600 since 1969, and Honda Civic since 1973, and new roll-on, roll-off vessels, mostly with built-in retractable loading ramps, were designed to meet those needs. After years of slow adoption, VW sales peaked at 570,000 units in 1970, and Japanese designs continued to gain US market share over the coming decades. Fortunately, there was no problem meeting the propulsion needs of these new large ships. The pre-Second World War sizes of the largest diesel engine had more than doubled by the late 1950s to more than 10 megawatts, as their efficiencies approached 50%. Subsequently, the maximum power of these massive multi-cylinder engines rose to 35 megawatts by the late 1960s and to more than 40 megawatts by 1973. Any diesel engines rated above 30 megawatts can power the largest ULCC, and hence the size of these vessels has never been limited by the availability of adequate prime movers. The quest for a practical gas turbine, a radically new prime mover in which fuel is sprayed into a stream of compressed air in order to generate a high-temperature gas that expands and exits the machine at high speed, resulted in the first stationary turbine for electricity generation in 1938, just as the first practical designs for jet engines emerged independently and at nearly the same time in pre-war England and Germany. Frank Whittle and Hans von Ohain were the first engineers to test turbines that were sufficiently efficient and reliable to power military airplanes. Small numbers of these jets were used in combat in late 1944. Too late to have any effect on the predetermined course of the war, but after its end, the British industry pressed its advantage, and in 1949, the Comet became the world's first commercial jetliner, powered by Ford de Havilland Ghost turbojet engines. Unfortunately, by 1954, a series of fatal accidents, not related to the engines, forced the withdrawal of the plane from service. And when a redesigned Comet returned in 1958, it was quickly overshadowed by Boeing's 707, the first design of a still-expanding family of jetliners. The second in line was the tri-engine Boeing 727, and in 1967 came the Boeing 737, the smallest plane of the series. In 1966, William Allen, the company's chairman, took a bold decision, investing more than twice the company's worth and hence essentially betting its future on the success of the project to develop the first wide-body jetliner. Supersonic jets were expected to take over intercontinental routes. The development of the British-French Concorde began in 1964, but supersonic flight remained restricted to the expensive and noisy Concorde, and it was Boeing's 747 that became the most revolutionary plane design in history. The plane was actually conceived as a freighter. Its wide body allowed the placing of two standard ship containers side by side, and the cockpit and the top bubble made it possible to turn up the nose for front loading. The prototype took off less than 3 years after Pan Am's order for 25 of the 747s, and the first commercial flight left New York for London on January the 21st, 1970. The plane's size, a maximum takeoff weight of 333 tons, was made possible by deploying four Pratt & Whitney turbofan engines. Unlike turbojet engines, where all compressed air moves through the combustion chamber, in turbofans, larger masses of less compressed and hence slower moving air bypass the combustor and help to generate higher thrust during takeoff, and do so with less noise. Engines on 707s had a bypass ratio of 1 to 1. On the 747, it was 4.8 to 1, with nearly five times as much air bypassing the turbine. Total deliveries of the 747 have added up to 1,548 planes in half a century of production, and Boeing estimates that during those five decades, the planes carried 5.9 billion people, the equivalent of about 75% of the world's population. The plane's revolutionary design changed intercontinental travel, as wide-body jets have transported hundreds of millions of people to a growing number of destinations with steadily declining costs and increasing safety. The integration of the global economy has been closely tied to the introduction of wide-body jetliners, to the Boeing 747 and to its later Airbus A340 and A380 emulators. Their services have been particularly important for Asian exporters, who use them to deliver on short notice many highly sought-after or seasonal items, the latest mobile phone brands, Christmas gifts, to North American and European markets. And wide-body airplanes enabled mass-scale tourism to previously rarely visited destinations. Runways long enough to accommodate 747s are in Bali and Tenerife, Nairobi and Tahiti. Intercontinental immigration trips and educational exchanges. Of course, the advances of globalization were closely tied not only to the rising capacities and better performance of powerful prime movers, but also to the relentless miniaturization of components needed for computing, information processing, and communication. The development of radio and later of television and the first electronic computers depended on deploying a variety of vacuum tubes, beginning with diodes and triodes during the first decade of the 20th century. Four decades later, our reliance on these large assemblies of hot glass became a limiting factor for the development of electronic computing. ENIAC, the first electronic general-purpose digital computer, had 17,648 vacuum tubes, a volume of about 80 cubic meters, the footprint of roughly two badminton courts. With its power supply and cooling system, it weighed about 30 tons, and its frequent operating interruptions were caused by recurrent failures of tubes that required near-constant maintenance and replacement. The first practical transistors, solid-state devices performing the same functions as glass-enclosed devices, became commercially available during the early 1950s. And before the decade's end, the ideas of several American inventors, Robert Noyce, Jack Kilby, Gene Herney, Kurt Lehovec, and Muhammad Atalla, resulted in the production of the first integrated circuits with active transistors and passive capacitors, resistors, components built and interconnected on a thin layer of silicon, a semiconducting material. These circuits can perform any specified computing functions, and their first practical uses were in rockets and space exploration. The next critical step was taken by Intel in 1969, when it began to design the world's first microprocessor, emplacing more than 2,000 transistors on a single silicon wafer in order to perform a complete set of prescribed functions. In the case of Intel's pioneering 4044, it was to run a small Japanese electronic calculator. The 4044 founded Intel's decades-long prominence in microchip design that led to the first personal computers, the relatively expensive, slow, and heavy desktops of the late 1970s and early 1980s, and portable electronics ranging from mobile phones, the first costly designs of the late 1980s, to laptops, tablets, and smartphones. The years between 1950 and 1973 were marked by rapid economic growth in virtually every part of the world. Its global annual mean rate and its average per capita gains were nearly 2.5 times greater than during the previous globalization wave of 1850 to 1913, and the value of exported goods in the world economic product rose from a low of just over 4% in 1945 to 9.6% in 1950 and about 14% in 1974, equaling the 1913 share, but with trade volume nearly 10 times higher. Economic growth was nearly universal. China's Great Famine years of 1958 to 1961 were the most consequential exception. But the benefits of this golden age of economic expansion, the post-war rebound, with high rates of growth helping to decrease economic inequality, were disproportionately concentrated in the West. By 1973, North America and the countries of Western Europe accounted for more than 60% of global exports. As the major Western European economies, Germany, UK, France, and Japan became the era's most dynamic traders, inevitably America's share in world trade gradually eroded. While trade was expanding and consumers in Western countries enjoyed greater access to a wider variety of imports, international travel, be it for business or leisure, remained relatively limited, as did international migration and the numbers of people studying or temporarily working abroad. Germans did not fly to Thailand or Hawaii. They drove to Italian beaches. The share of immigrants in the US population, which peaked at nearly 15% just before the First World War, reached a new low of less than 5% in 1970. And the suggestion that China, cut off from the world by Mao-inspired convulsions, would send masses of students to American universities would have been seen as nothing but an improbable fiction. And then, for reasons explained in the first chapter where I traced modern civilization's dependence on crude oil, it seemed that the post-war spell of limited but intensive globalization was over. OPEC-driven oil price increases caused globalization to falter, weaken, and recede. But this retreat did not affect all economic sectors. And in a matter of years, a combination of effective adjustments laid foundations for a new round of globalization that, thanks to new political alignments, progressed further than any of the preceding waves. Enter China, Russia, India. This time, the expansion, enabled as always by technical factors, went so far because, for the first time in modern history, it could go that far. By the late 1960s, technical capabilities were ready for unprecedented global integration. Energy supply was plentiful, there was no shortage of money to invest, and all that was needed was to extend the globalization process to the nations that did not participate in the first post-war round. This began finally when the technical and financial means became decisively augmented and potentiated by fundamental political reversals, as China, Russia, and India became major participants in global trade, finances, travel, and talent flows. The gradual opening of China began in 1972 with Richard Nixon's visit to Beijing, took a decisive turn in late 1978, 2 years after Mao Zedong's death, with the rise of Deng Xiaoping and the launching of long overdue economic reforms, the de facto privatization of farming, modernization of industry, and partial return to private enterprise, and accelerated after China joined the World Trade Organization, WTO, in 2001. In 1972, China had no trade with the US. 1984 was the last year the US had a surplus trading goods with Beijing. In 2009, China became the world's largest exporter of goods. And by 2018, its exports accounted for more than 12% of all global sales. And its trade surplus with the US reached nearly $420 billion before declining by about 18% in 2019 due to rising tensions between the two economic superpowers. But it is too early to forecast any long-term retreat in trade or return to ever tighter economic integration. After decades of the Cold War, the USSR began to unravel during the late 1980s. Its satellite states detached themselves first. The Berlin Wall fell on the 9th of November 1989, and the Soviet state was officially dissolved on December 26, 1991. For the first time in history, it became possible for every major economy to become open, still to varying but in nearly all cases unprecedented degrees, to foreign investment, intensifying international trade, and populations previously forbidden to travel freely abroad joined mass-scale tourism and took advantage of new opportunities to emigrate and to temporarily work and study abroad. Trade expansion took place within a globally agreed framework provided by the WTO. India, with its messy electoral and multi-ethnic politics, has not been able to replicate China's post-1990 rise driven by the unchallenged rule of a single party, but the record of its per capita GDP growth during the first two decades of the 21st century indicates a clear departure from the previous decades of poor performance. Between 1970 and 1990, the country's per capita GDP, in constant monies, had actually declined in six separate years and stayed below 4% for 4 years, while between 2000 and 2019, there was an annual growth above 4% for 18 of those years. Moreover, since 2008, the country's annual growth of merchandise exports has been at 5.3%, only slightly behind China's 5.7%, and the impact of India's software engineers in Silicon Valley, where they have been the single most important contingent of skilled immigrants in the industry, has been far above Chinese contributions. India's rise has coincided with the marginalisation of the Congress Party that ruled the country for decades after it gained its independence in 1947, while both Russia and China have retained many attributes of central economic and social control. Unlike in the new nationalist Russia, the Communist Party remains in firm command in China. Both countries have allowed, with notable repressive exceptions, freedom of travel that has led to new waves of tourists, with favourite destinations being the Mediterranean countries for the Russians, Thailand, Japan, and Europe for the Chinese, and there has been an unprecedented influx of Chinese, Indian, and South Korean students to the West, above all to the US. International trade's share in the world economic product rose from about 30% in 1973 to nearly 61% in 2008, while the total volume of trade, in constant monies, increased almost exactly sixfold, with most of the rise taking place since 1999. The financial crisis of 2008 to 2009 cut the total volume by a tenth and trade's share of economic output by about 15% in 2009. But by 2018, overall trade was 35% above the 2008 peak, and trade's share of the world economic product was back above 59%, and the numbers changed little in 2019. Foreign direct investment, measured as net outflows per year, is another obvious marker of globalization. In 1973, its global total was less than $30 billion, about 0.7% of the global economic product. 2 decades later, it rose to $256 billion. But by 2007, it soared to $3.12 trillion, nearly 5.5% of the global product, a 12-fold increase in just 14 years, with Asia, and above all China, as the main destination. A Russian team measured the progress of post-2000 globalization by combining all key markers, that is, by analyzing changes in the trade in goods, trade in services, and accumulated stocks of bilateral foreign direct investment, particularly important for China, and also migrants, non-existent in China but important for the American economy. Not surprisingly, the results show the largest gains for previously isolated Russia, other former European communist economies, and China, and also for India, some African countries, and Brazil. Moreover, as a result of these shifts, by 2017, the global connectedness of China was as high as that of Japan. Russia's rivaled that of Sweden, and India could be compared with Singapore. If any of these pairings strikes you as questionable, just think of China's place as the largest manufacturer of consumer goods, of Russia's enormous exports of energy and minerals, and of the already noted contingent of Indian software engineers in Silicon Valley. Globalization's multiples. Perhaps the best way to appreciate the technical advances that made this truly unprecedented globalization possible is to express their progress as multiples of their capacities, ratings, efficiencies, or performances. As already explained, the technical foundations for this dizzying round of globalization were laid before 1973. But its extent and intensity since then has demanded enormous investment in prime movers, combustion engines and electric motors in transportation, and in essential infrastructures, ports, airports, containerized shipping. As a result, we have not only more of them, but their average capacities, power, volume, throughput, have become larger, while their typical efficiencies and reliabilities have become better. So let's look at the advances that have taken place in shipping, flying, navigating, computing, and communicating since the early 1970s. Post-1973 globalization has more than tripled the mass of seaborne trade and brought major shifts in its composition. While in 1973, tanker traffic, dominated by crude oil and refined products, accounted for more than half of the transported total, in 2018, goods amounted to about 70%, a shift reflecting not only the rise of Asia, and above all China, as the world's leading source of consumer goods, but the overall increase in integration and interdependence. German car makers assemble vehicles in Alabama. Texas-made chemicals, taking advantage of the boom in the extraction of natural gas, provide feedstocks for EU industries. Chilean fruits are exported to four continents, and Somali camels are shipped to Saudi Arabia. This tripling of shipped mass between 1973 and 2019 required, when measured in deadweight tons, a near quadrupling of the global merchant fleet capacity. Deadweight tonnage of oil tankers slightly more than tripled, the tonnage of container ships increased about 4.5 times, and the size of the global container fleet expanded roughly tenfold in 45 years to 5,152 ships in 2019. This order of magnitude increase was accompanied by a massive shift of container activity to China in 1975. China had no container traffic, and US and Japanese ports accounted for nearly half of the global activity. In 2018, China, including Hong Kong, held a 32% share, while the combined US and Japanese share was less than 10%. As for maximum ship sizes, in 1972 and 1973, Malcolm McLean launched his largest container vessels, each with a capacity of 1,968 standard steel containers, nearly five times larger than his first converted vessels in 1957. In 1996, Regina Maersk could load 6,000 standard units. By 2008, the maximum was 13,800. And in 2019, the Mediterranean Shipping Company put into service six giant vessels, each able to carry 23,756 standard containers, hence a 12-fold increase of maximum vessel capacity between 1973 and 2019. Inevitably, this mass-scale conversion to container shipping required the commensurate conversion of freight trains and truck transportation, and these intermodal chains now bring the goods from a city in China's interior to the loading dock of a Walmart in Missouri. And when the shipment of expensive food or flowers, freshly caught tuna from Atlantic Canada to Tokyo, green beans from Kenya to London, roses from Ecuador to New York, or high-value electronics require speed, they go by air. The belly hold of every passenger airplane carries goods, as does the growing fleet of air freighters. As a result, between 1973 and 2018, global air freight, expressed in ton kilometres, rose about 12-fold, while scheduled passenger traffic rose from about 0.5 trillion to more than 8.3 trillion passenger kilometres, nearly a 17-fold gain. Nearly two-thirds, 5.3 trillion passenger kilometres, of the latest total were on international flights, the equivalent of flying nearly half a billion people a year from New York to London and back again. An increasing share of these flights is being taken by international tourists. In the early 1970s, their annual global total, dominated by Americans and Western Europeans, was below 200 million. By 2018, the new record reached 1.4 billion. Europe remains the main tourist destination, accounting for half of the total arrivals, with France, Spain, and Italy being the continent's most visited countries. For generations, the US led overall tourist expenditures, but it was surpassed by China in 2012, and 5 years later, Chinese tourists were spending twice as much as Americans. The rather sudden multiplication of arrivals and their disproportionate concentration in several major cities, Paris, Venice, Barcelona, has led to complaints by their permanent residents and to the first moves to limit the numbers of daily or annual visitors. The long reach of Moore's Law. Increases in moving materials, products and people, as well as the necessity of delivering materials or components just in time for new industries working without extensive inventories, were enabled and made more reliable by gains in navigation, tracking, computing and communication, and much expanded capabilities were also needed to accommodate the new deluge of international data flows. All of these advances have one fundamental technical foundation: our ability to emplace more components on an integrated circuit whose progress, doubling roughly every 2 years, has been so far conforming to the prediction made by Gordon Moore, at that time Fairchild Semiconductor's Director of Research, in 1965. In 1969, Moore became Intel's co-founder, and, as already noted, in 1971, the company released its first microprocessor, or microchip, with 2,300 components. Microprocessor fabrication had eventually advanced from large-scale integration, up to 100,000 components, to very large-scale integration, VLSI, up to 10 million components, and to ultra-large-scale integration, ULSI, up to a billion components. The 10 to the power of 5 mark, 100,000 transistors, was reached in 1982. And in 1996, to celebrate the machine's 50th anniversary, a group of students at the University of Pennsylvania recreated ENIAC by putting 174,569 transistors on a 7.4mm by 5.3mm silicon microchip. The original machine was more than 5 million times heavier. It required about 40,000 times more electricity, and the recreated chip was 500 times faster. And the progress continued. The 10 to the power of 8 mark was surpassed in 2003, 10 to the power of 9 in 2010, and by the end of 2019, AMD released its EPYC CPU with 39.5 billion transistors. This means that between 1971 and 2019, microprocessor power increased by 7 orders of magnitude, 17.1 billion times to be exact. These advances were more than enough to accommodate new demands for massive data transfers, from Earth observation, spy and communication satellites, and among financial centers and data storages, instant email and voice calls, and highly accurate navigation. That last capability has benefited from advances in radar detection and by the setting up and subsequent expansion and improvement of global positioning systems, or GPS. The first American system was fully operational in 1993. And three other systems, Russia's GLONASS, EU's Galileo, China's BeiDou, followed. As a result, Everybody with a computer or a mobile phone can now see worldwide shipping and aviation activities in real time, just by clicking on the marine traffic website and watching cargo vessels, green icons, converging on Shanghai and Hong Kong, lining up to pass between Bali and Lombok, or going up the English Channel. To see tankers, red, debouching from the Persian Gulf. Tugs and special craft, turquoise, serving the oil and gas production rigs in the North Sea. And fishing vessels, light brown, roaming the Central Pacific. And there are many more ships there and elsewhere that do not show on the screen because, while fishing illegally, they turn off their transponders. Analogical, and no less fascinating, is the click-away opportunity to monitor all commercial flights. Early morning in Europe shows a long arc of staggered flights approaching the continent after crossing the Atlantic during the night from North and South America. Evenings in North America show the long streams of jetliners following the optimal flight paths to Europe. Trans-Pacific flights to Japan converge on Narita and Haneda during late afternoons and early evenings Tokyo time. Moreover, flight tracking makes it possible to trace changing flight paths that take into account the frequently shifting position of the jet stream. Less frequent flight path adjustments are caused by the progress of major cyclones or by ash clouds emitted by volcanic eruptions. Inevitability, setbacks, and overreach. The history of globalization reveals an undeniable long-term trend toward greater international economic integration that is manifested by intensified flows of energies, materials, people, ideas, and information, and that is enabled by improving technical capabilities. The process is not new, but only thanks to many post-1850 innovations could it have reached its recent intensity and extent. But, as some past setbacks indicate, these technical advances do not make continued progress inevitable. Most notably, the first half of the 20th century saw a significant retreat from economic globalization and hence also from the accompanying international movement of people. The reasons for this retreat are obvious, as the decades were marked by an unprecedented concatenation of large-scale tragedies and reversals of national fortunes. The list, limited to the key events, includes the end of the Qing, China's last imperial dynasty, 1912, the First World War, 1914 to 1918, the end of Tsarist Russia, when the Bolsheviks took power and years of civil war followed, ending with the establishment of the USSR, 1917 to 1921, the unravelling of the Ottoman Empire, final dissolution by 1923, the political instability in Europe of the post-war 1920s, the stock market collapse in late October 1929, the subsequent worldwide economic crises that lasted for most of the 1930s, Japan's invasion of Manchuria, 1931, the true beginning of another great war, the Nazi takeover of Germany, 1933, the Spanish Civil War, 1936 to 1939, the Second World War, 1939 to 1945, the renewed civil war in China, 1945 to 1949, the beginning of the Cold War, 1947, and Mao's proclamation of the People's Republic of China in 1949. The retreat of economic globalization was substantial. The share of trade in global GDP fell from about 14% in 1913 to about 6% in 1939, and then to only 4% in 1945. And the accelerated post-1990 pace of globalization did not depend on just having superior technical means. It would have been impossible without concurrent major political and social transformations, most notably the post-1980 return of China to international commerce, followed, between 1989 and 1991, by the dismantling of the Soviet Empire. This means that the high degree of globalization reached during the first two decades of the 21st century has not been inevitable, and that it can be weakened by future developments. To what extent, marginally or substantially, and how rapidly, fast due to major power confrontations, gradually is a generational affair, is impossible to foresee. Much seems to be firmly set in place. A great deal of accreted globalization, especially many changes that unfolded during the past two generations, is here to stay. Too many countries now rely on food imports, and self-sufficiency in all raw materials is impossible, even for the largest countries, because no country possesses sufficient reserves of all minerals needed by its economy. The UK and Japan import more food than they produce. China does not have all the iron ore it needs for its blast furnaces. The US buys many rare earth metals, from lanthanum to yttrium, and India is chronically short of crude oil. The inherent advantages of mass-scale manufacturing preclude companies from assembling mobile phones in every city in which they are purchased, and millions of people will still try to see iconic distant places before they die. Moreover, instant reversals are not practical, and rapid disruptions could come only with high costs attached. For example, the global supply of consumer electronics would suffer enormously if Shenzhen suddenly ceased to function as the world's most important manufacturing hub of portable devices. But history reminds us that the recent state of things is unlikely to last for generations. British and American industries were the global leaders as recently as the early 1970s. But where are Birmingham's metalworking factories or Baltimore's steel furnaces now? Where are the great cotton mills of Manchester or of South Carolina? By 1965, Detroit's Big Three still had 90% of the US car market. Now, they do not have even 45%. Until 1980, Shenzhen was a small fishing village when it became China's first special economic zone. And now it is a megacity with more than 12 million people. What role will it play in 2050? A mass-scale, rapid retreat from the current state is impossible, but the pro-globalization sentiment has been weakening for some time. The accelerated deindustrialization of North America, Europe, and Japan, and the shift of manufacturing to Asia in general and to China in particular, has been the leading reason for this reappraisal. This manufacturing switch has brought changes ranging from risible to tragic. In the first category are such grotesque transactions as Canada, the country with per capita forest resources greater than in any other affluent nation, importing toothpicks and toilet paper from China, a country whose wood stocks amount to a small fraction of Canada's enormous boreal forest patrimony. But the switch has also contributed to tragedies, such as the rising midlife mortality among America's white non-university educated men. There can be no doubt that America's post-2000 loss of some 7 million formerly well-paying manufacturing jobs, with most of that loss attributable to globalization, as most of that production moved to China, has been the principal reason of these deaths of despair, largely attributable to suicide, drug overdose, and alcohol-induced liver disease. And we now have solid, quantitative confirmation that globalization did reach a turning point in the mid-2000s. This development was soon obscured by the Great Recession of 2008, but McKinsey's analysis of 23 industry value chains, interconnected activities from design to retail that deliver final products, spanning 43 countries between 1995 to 2017, shows that goods-producing value chains, still growing slowly in absolute terms, have become significantly less trade-intensive, with exports declining from 28.1% of gross output in 2007 to 22.5% in 2017. What I see to be the study's second most important finding is that, contrary to common perception, only about 18% of the global goods trade is now driven by lower labour costs, or labour arbitrage, that in many chains this share has been declining throughout the 2010s, and that global value chains are becoming more knowledge-intensive and rely increasingly on highly skilled labour. Similarly, an OECD study shows that the expansion of global value chains stopped in 2011 and since then has slightly declined. There has been less trade in intermediate goods and services. Add to this the justified or exaggerated, thoughtful or demagogic fears about globalization's impact on national sovereignty, culture and language, about diluting cherished peculiarities in the solvent of commercial universality, with concerns ranging from the ubiquity of American fast food chains to the essentially unchecked power of social media, And, contrary to promised benefits, worries about globalization's role in economic and social inequality. Even a restrained appraisal of these real and perceived negatives confirms enough downsides to question any future intensification of the process, and in 2020, COVID-19 reinforced such sentiments. Arguments for reshoring many kinds of manufacturing in order to gain greater resilience and reduce unexpected disruptions are not new. The progress of globalization and the actions of multinational companies have been questioned and criticized since the 1990s, and more recently, these sentiments became part of electoral discontent in some countries, most notably in the UK and the US. But as the COVID-19 pandemic unfolded, a remarkable lineup of institutions began to publish analyses and appeals for the reorganization of global supply chains. The OECD looked at the policy options to build more resilient production networks that would rely less on imports from distant places and that could better withstand global trade interruptions. The United Nations Conference on Trade and Development considered repatriating manufacturing from Asia to North America and Europe and a shift to shorter, less fragmented value chains, extending from design through manufacturing to distribution within a single country or a single economic unit that would produce a higher concentration of value added. Swiss Re produced a report about the de-risking of global supply chains, rebalancing them to strengthen resilience. And the Brookings Institution saw the reshoring of advanced manufacturing as the best way to create good jobs. Questioning and criticizing globalization has gone beyond narrowly ideological arguments, and the COVID-19 pandemic provided additional powerful arguments based on irrefutable concerns about the state's fundamental role in protecting the lives of its citizens. That role is hard to play when 70% of the world's rubber gloves are made in a single factory, and when similar or even higher shares of not just other pieces of personal protective equipment, but also of principal drug components and common medications, antibiotics, anti-hyperintensive drugs, come from a very small number of suppliers in China and India. Such dependence might fulfill an economist's dream of mass output at the lowest possible unit cost, but it makes for extremely irresponsible, if not criminal, governance when doctors and nurses have to face a pandemic without adequate PPE, when states depend on foreign production, engage in dismaying competition for limited supplies, and when patients around the world cannot renew their prescriptions because of the slowdowns or closures in Asian factories. And security concerns created by excessive globalization go far beyond the healthcare sector. Rising US imports of large Chinese transformers create worries about the availability of spare parts and about the potential for future grid destabilization. And there is little need to repeat the arguments about the much publicized ban on Huawei's participation in the 5G networks of some Western nations. Not surprisingly, the reshoring of manufacturing could be the wave of the future, both in North America and in Europe. A 2020 survey showed that 64% of American manufacturers said that reshoring is likely following the pandemic. Will this sentiment persist? As I never fail to stress, I do not forecast, and hence I am not offering any specific numbers concerning the retreat or continuation of the pre-COVID levels of globalization in general, or of the reshoring of manufacturing capacities in particular. I just try to appraise the range of the most likely outcomes, and while in recent years it has looked increasingly as if most aspects of globalization will not soar to new highs, in 2020 this notion became entirely unexceptional. We may have seen the peak of globalization, and its ebb may last not just for years, but for decades to come.